The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
Good morning and welcome to Guardian Radio AM. Today is Friday, December 29th. And it's a little after 11 o'clock in the morning. Once again, this is C.A. Nuri, and we're going to be talking history. We're talking history today about the Christmas time in the Bahamas, Christmas time amongst Africans. Christmas time, I guess, with Europeans, because Europeans was here too. But we're talking Bahamas and Christmas time, right? So, of course, I brought in a historian. I brought in historian Christopher Davis. And we know that he's a Pan-African. So most of his research is Afrocentric. So I just gave him that a pretext. So that's what our conversation is going to be about, right? And I want to talk about revolts. This topic is important to me because I just don't know. I've been challenged on this before, and I said, well, I haven't done the research. So I said, perhaps I can get a historian to guide me through. So when I have these type of conversation, I'm able to give proper information on it, right? So without further ado, I'm going to have Christopher introduce himself again, and then I'll start poking him with some questions about African Revolution in the Bahamas. Did it actually happen, right? Talk about some plantations that exist. Talk about some family trees and family lineages, you know, general information about that. And if you're interested in that, call. The numbers are 323-6232, 325-4316, 325-4259. And of course, if you're on the family island, it's 242-300-5720. So, Christopher Davis, where you be at nowadays?
Well, I'm at Clifton Heritage Park. And out of Clifton Heritage Park, as a manager now of research and you know, the gift shop, several other things. Excuse me. And in my role at Clifton, I have been pushing my, of course, African narrative, more so the narrative that is more reflective and more relevant to the majority of Bahamians today. So happy to be here, you know, and in order to be here. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. So let's start our conversation and speed up this conversation, right? Have there ever been any successful slave revolts in the Bahamas?
Well, overly successful, we would know that the most successful revolt uprising would have been the Haitian Revolution. Now, in the Bahamas, we have had successful revolts in the context of how it influenced the broader struggle and movement for all Africans, enslaved Africans, in the Western Hemisphere. And ironically, some of these things typically happen around the Christmas season. And so, yes, in the Bahamas, we've had several revolts and other incidences of resistance, including arson, the concept of the Saltwater Underground Railroad, and probably being the country with the highest runaway rate per capita as well.
No, let's say that again. The Bahamas had a lot of runaways?
Oh, yeah, man. We was running away like crazy.
But no. I can't let you slide. And the reason why I can't let you slide is the narrative that I learned in history class. We were the best treated Africans, enslaved Africans, in the Caribbean, in the region, compared to the United States, definitely compared to Haiti and South America, right? We were treated good. We had days off. We got access to farm. And you're saying that we had runaways?
Oh, yeah, big time. So just for an example, even on the plantation that belonged to William Wiley, which is actually now at Clifton Heritage Park, where I work, you even see that some of the enslaved people that he empowered, so we're talking about the driver, the cook, the overseer, even they ran away at certain times. So in 1800, for example, you had Sue Eve, who was a Mandingo African who was brought to the Bahamas by Abraham Eve, the brother of Joseph Eve, who invented the cotton gin. So here we have William Wiley, who was one of the major ones touted by may she rest in peace, Gail Saunders, Michael Creighton, and others, as this quote-unquote benevolent slave master.
Yes, he's benevolent.
But I have found a newspaper article, actually, that dates back to about 1815, where he's bragging about how he made £5 an acre, and at the time his property was over 1,000 acres a year. And in those days, that was well, that would probably would have been well over $1 million in today's money. And he did that by working enslaved people for 16 hours a day. So I don't know where people get this narrative. Now, things were different in the Bahamas. But at the same time, if you actually want some proof, anyone can go on Google right now and download The Life of Mary Prince, The Life of a West Indian Slave. She spent time enslaved in Antigua, a little bit of time in Bermuda, Jamaica as well, and parts of mainland North America. And she said that her worst experience as being enslaved was actually in the Bahamas. And she was mostly employed in raking salt. And raking salt was just as tedious, just as deadly, and arguably more deadly than working on one of the sugar plantations of Haiti or one of the cotton plantations of Georgia. But for anybody, you know, I could run on and on, but I could dispel that lie about Bahamian history in 1 minute. So most of our enslavers and slave masters were these people that we call the loyalists, right? Those were people who were in the present-day United States, not the 13 colonies at the time or whatever you want to call it. Where did they come from? They came from Virginia.
Yes.
They came from North Carolina.
There's monsters down there.
Georgia.
Yes.
All right. Have you ever watched a movie or read, seen any documentary, read any book about slavery?
Mm-hmm.
Those were the worst places to be enslaved. So what is it in the Bahamas, something special in the Bahamian Breeze that make these loyalists come to the Bahamas, fall asleep one day and wake up the other day, and all of a sudden they start treating black people well? It is absolute insanity to even say that. In hindsight, the problem is, too, that many of the people that observed slavery in the Bahamas were, in fact, the enslavers themselves. So you have people like Daniel McKinnon, who was a pro-slavery advocate, who came here and was talking about how nice the slaves was treated, talking about slaves being sold, enslaved Africans, being sold out of what is today Pompey Museum, which was Van Dew House at the time. But the two documentations that we have from people who is experiencing that comes from the woman I mentioned before, Mary Prince, who actually went on to be one of the first published British black women. And if we had to pick one person who swung their mighty sword and ended slavery, it would have been her. So while William Wilberforce was strung out from his opium addiction that he was taking, I believe, to treat bronchitis or some disease, she was the one going door to door and tugging on the heartstrings of the British public that even made it possible for emancipation to happen.
These alternative narratives.
And this are our people now.
So the slave ship Creole, I think that's the slave ship Creole.
Yeah.
Few Bahamians know about this. Black Americans, African Americans have this as a harrowing story.
Yep.
Right? Mm-hmm. They have that as one of the most successful revolts in their history.
Yep.
But where did that happen?
That happened right 100 miles east of a place called Hole in the Wall, which is southeast of the island of Abaco.
That can't happen into the Bahamas with Bahamians not knowing. Like I said, everyone who is an African American, right? Of course, I'm using these general and broad terms, right? Knows about the slave ship Creole. It's a big thing in African American history and culture.
Right.
They tout it in all the storybooks. Yeah. And you're trying to say something as grand, as big, as divine as that happened in the Bahamas?
Oh, yes, it happened in the Bahamas. Not only did it happen in the Bahamas, I would argue that many of our ancestors actually participated in the success of this revolt.
Give me a narrative, because I'm not sure you're trying to say we participated.
What did I say?
Because I have roots in Abaco, and I'm trying to say that perhaps you're trying to say one of us helped in that Creole revolution.
Well, this is a very, very long and powerful story. And this story actually ended in our beloved Gambia village, where we like to go every Sunday, you know, to party and eat some nice tropical conch salad. And they're actually descendants of a man named Elijah Morris, who lived in Gambia Village, who was one of the leaders of this slave revolt that we talk about. The reason it's considered the most successful is because it ended with the freedom of about 145 African Americans. Many of them ended up getting married, and the leader, Madison Washington, he was actually one of the characters that inspired the movie Django Unchained. Because from his perspective, much of it was being done to rescue his beloved wife, Susan Washington, whose name I saw on the manifest, even though there was a big age gap between the two. However, what is true is that when they finally took the ship, a few miles east
of Abaco. You're going too quickly.
Okay.
The ship was sailing through the Bahamas, and what happened?
Well, it wasn't sailing through the Bahamas. It was kind of off course. They were considered refractory and disobedient enslaved people who were being transported from Virginia to New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process of that transportation, they ended up in the Bahamas. Now, what is interesting is this is a part of the concept called the Saltwater Underground Railroad that I mentioned last time. And this was not the first time something like this happened. This is just the first time it happened in an all-out revolt or mutiny that was successful. But you had other incidences where these ships crashed, typically off the coast of Abaco, actually, and then these people were then freed in the Bahamas. This is separate from those ships that came from Africa, where the Africans were highly discriminated against and were required to serve a 7 to 14 year apprenticeship, even after slavery had ended in the Bahamas. And so to call them liberated Africans is highly inaccurate, and I think that the term displaced Africans is more accurate. But all of these things would be nice and curated and neatly put out there for Bahamians to view at Clifton Heritage Park in short order.
Mm-hmm. So, but finish with the slave ship Creole, what happened?
Okay, so what happened was they took over the ship. Madison Washington and Elijah Morris were the two dominant leaders. They had learned from other incidences. Now, I have to segue from this because there was another famous slave revolt on a ship
mm-hmm.
that occurred in the Bahamas, and that is the famous Amistad revolt.
Amistad didn't happen to me. I watched that movie. I watched Amistad. But let's finish Creole, then we should do it quickly, and then we go to Amistad. Because right. I watched Amistad,
so when
they didn't mention the Bahamas.
Of course not. So when they took the ship, their first thought was to go to Liberia, which was this new colony where our freed African-Americans were supposed to go, but they didn't have the provisions to do that. Then they said, let's go to that place where Lumpkin slaves were freed, quoting that. So Robert Lumpkin was the wealthiest man, big-time slave trader in Virginia at the time. And these people already knew that he had lost a sizable chunk of his enslaved population in the Bahamas. And this was something that was known among the black population, the African population in the Bahamas. And by the time as that ship entered right there in the harbor where the cruise ships are today, right where Pompey Square is today, that is where this revolt ended. And by the time as they pulled in there, they were being escorted by hundreds of typical Bahamian sailors, most of whom were black, and we were parading and celebrating in the streets. And the second that ship landed, 129 enslaved African-Americans got their freedom.
You're trying to say that this happened to the Bahamas and Bahamians are not aware of it? That Africans came from over the hill
and helped these mutineers,
mm-hmm. African mutineers, when they found they're here in Nassau and say, y'all free now, y'all ain't going no place.
Yep.
Because I remember one time, United States wanted to be compensated. That's the same story?
Same story.
Do that part and we'll skip.
And actually, as a matter of fact, they were compensated. You see, this is the farce of these notions of freedom and stuff, especially when it's done at the behest of the enslaver themselves. There was always a compensation involved. And in 1853, they were compensated for the Comet, the Creole, and the Anconium, all three of those ships were American slave traders that either crashed or had a revolt in the Bahamas, and then we freed them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Americans kept mad because we stole their property, and that was where the British government had to compensate them.
And we're going to the Amistad story now, but I want to summarize that. Apparently it was a congressman, slave ship or property, whatever it is, mm-hmm. and that the United States petitioned war and yep. say that they're going to declare war on the Bahamas yes. and invade the Bahamas or some sort like that, and unless they get compensated. And that's where the British government say, hey, okay, the Bahamas is a protectorate of the United Kingdom, therefore let's pay this bill off, something to that effect.
Right, it was something to that effect.
Okay.
And then notice now, this is about 10 years before the Civil War then started,
yes.
where the Bahamas participated.
On the other side.
On the wrong side.
On the wrong side. And people forget that we resupplied the southern states, mm-hmm. The enslavers, during that time giving them supplies. But let me hear about this Amistad story, because I thought that happened in the United States.
No, so the Amistad, what actually happened is they arrived on another ship. All of this is actually in my book, Black Rinse. All that I'm talking about now is in my book, Black Rinse. So with the Amistad now, they arrived in eastern Cuba, and the Amistad ship was actually the ship that was taking them from eastern Cuba to western Cuba. These were people that arrived from present-day Windward Coast. So many of them were Mendes, Mandingos, Temnes, Serras, warlords, the Yazidis people, many of them were actually Islamic as well, you know. Now, and as a matter of fact, they had the highest rate of slave revolts on ships. And we can talk about another one in the Bahamas right after we talk about this one. So when they was going from Eastern Cuba to Western Cuba, that actually happened just south of Ragged Island. Okay, that's where the revolt actually happened. They took the ship. Then, according to the court documents, they were in the Bahamas for upwards of 2 months.
Mm-hmm. So, they're sailing around.
All right, then. So let me ask you this. How can a ship, because that voyage was only supposed to be for 2 days, and anyone who is a captain or a noble boatman, you have to prepare well when you're going on sea, right? So how is a voyage that, how they survive for 2 months on a voyage that's supposed to last 2 days? You understand?
That means they'll stop someplace.
They stop three places. The first place they stopped was New Providence. Now, this is in 1839, crucially, after 1808, when they say they end the slave trade. And this is where you see the false narrative of British so-called liberating Africans in the Bahamas. Because this actually came mostly, you know, from us. And there was a lot of politics involved. You see, this was a ship that was taken by Africans, not African-Americans now. Mm-hmm. Not people, not quote-unquote Creoles who were born in the Western Hemisphere. These were taken by Africans who were viewed as savages, as devil worshippers, and all of these things, right? So when they stopped in New Providence, surprise, surprise, they were denied entry by the colonial government.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? And, of course, this is why we made sure in 1841, 2 years later, when the Creole arrived, that that wasn't going to happen again.
Don't ain't get no denying this time.
All right, you get it. Now, back to 1839 with the Amistad. Then they went to another island. Now, this one ain't going to surprise you, Mr. Nuri. The other island they landed, I'll actually give you three guesses. So they landed on another island, and they ain't even hear what they had to say. They rolled them out quick.
Abaco.
Well, that good guess. No, not that one.
Spanish Bell?
Good guess.
I don't know. Where Long Island.
Long Island.
Okay, go to Long Island. What happened?
They got rolled out. Even worse than they got rolled out in New Providence. As a matter of fact, I don't even think they was able to, you know, speak to them like that. They just like, keep it moving. Mm-hmm. Y'all black Africans.
Anyone who come there and boat, they's right. Go ahead. Just finish the story.
Now, then they ended up off the coast of Southeast Andres, where we see Driggs Hill, where we see Congo Town. As a matter of fact, a man named Boatswain Wiley, who changed his name to Griffin, and his wife Chloe, who had run away in 1821 from the Wiley plantation, they were then sold to the Moss, the dreaded Moss family, in 1823. But after slavery had ended, him being a Congo African himself, he moved to Congo Town. And I'll bet you that Boatswain was one of the people from Congo Town, from Driggs Hill, who assisted the Amistad rebels by giving them provisions, giving them water, giving them food. And they settled and they docked right on Green Key so that the colonial government wouldn't be able to find out what was happening.
But how did they manage to get back to the United States?
So what happened was these were Mandingos, right? So typically when you read books about it, they try to say, oh, well, these was Africans and they didn't know about navigation. That is pure foolishness. They knew very well about navigation. The problem was they didn't know exactly where they were on the globe, on the map, you understand? But what they did know was that Africa was to the east. And so when the sun was up, they could see where east was. But what the captain, the guy who they left alive to steer the ship, what he did was in the nighttime, he would steer to the northwest. Then in the daytime, he would go very slowly to the east and like vaguely to the east. And as soon as the sun go down, he would slowly veer north. So that is why they landed so far up north.
Because
if you think about it, if they went straight to the U.S., they would have landed in Florida or probably Georgia. I would say more likely Florida. But they ended up all the way up there.
So this is another Long Island, high-end
in the U.S.
U.S. African-American history point that happened in the Bahamas that most Bahamians do not know about.
Right. Well, most Bahamians, most Americans, even with the Creole, I found that many African-Americans don't know about it. But they will know Madison Washington, who was the leader of the Creole Revolt. Right. Now, Creole, to make it clear, is the name of the ship.
Of the ship.
The word Creole is of French extraction, but Creole pretty much means what me and you are, what every black person is, just a person of African descent born in the Western Hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the French thing, it means any person born in the Western Hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
But in the vernacular of English speaking, Creole meant and means any person born of African descent, pure or partial, born in the Western Hemisphere. And in those days, they was meaning any slave born in the Western Hemisphere. And slave
I know you have another revolt story for me.
Right.
But I want to know about the slave Dick and Farquharson plantation? The one who shoot after the slave master.
Oh, yeah. There we go.
So who is that?
That is Dick DeVoe.
Dick DeVoe.
And that is the one of the voices we should focus on. This actually happened around Christmas time and because of Christmas time. Now, in Southern Kidd Island, there was a lot of harsh treatment. There was actually a lot of resistance that was going on in and around there, even though much wasn't reported. But this was like the culmination of this kind of pot that was bubbling, right? And so this year, this was in 1831, Christmas fell on a Sunday. Crucially, it's important to note that this was when the Baptist War, being led by Samuel Sharp, was also going on, and this was only a few weeks after the Nat Turner Revolt. So in the minds of the colonial governments over there in Europe, mm-hmm. this was widespread revolt in these English colonies and British colonies. You even had stuff going on in Barbados and Trinidad and Guyana at the same time, and now the Bahamas is about to join suit. So that's important to contextualize, that these revolts were truly meaningful. And these revolts, more so than the ramblings of these so-called white abolitionists, these revolts were more so the reason why we were able to eventually be freed from chattel slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Kidd Island, Christmas fell on a Sunday this year. So they wanted their 3 days off. So Dick DeVoe, who was actually the driver, it's important to realize, too, that when you really dive deep into studying these things, you realize that most of these profound revolts were led by the black man in charge,
mm-hmm.
the driver, the most privileged one. And that was simply because they had opportunities to think. Even though we typically see that character portrayed like Samuel L. Jackson and Django,
mm-hmm.
just an utter sellout, the reality is most of them were people who were trying to be a buffer between the slave master and enslaved. And most of them operated towards as best as they could, trying to lessen and diminish the pure trauma and depravity that the lower enslaved, quote-unquote, lower enslaved people would have experienced. So, and that was Dick DeVoe's role. He was actually the driver. Now, on Wednesday, he rang the bell and told his people not to come out. So he wanted to give the illusion that, yeah, he's still following the rules. I rang the bell, but they ain't come out,
mm-hmm.
right? But this was in defiance to them having their extra day off. And then the following day, Joseph Hunter, in his anger, it was a guy named Young Guy, who they accused of stealing oranges. All he did was eat an orange. And this fellow was about 17 at the time. But they missed with Charlotte DeVoe Child.
Mm.
So it ain't just about Dick DeVoe, it's about Charlotte DeVoe too. And let me tell you something, Charlotte DeVoe, we need to do a whole show on her and other women who led slave revolts in the Bahamas, because she was not the only one who was involved, and she was not even the only one who was a leader of a slave revolt in the Bahamas.
Some rowdy black Bahamian woman.
Oh yeah. So by this time now, Dick DeVoe stormed off, and he went and he had a big argument with Henry Williams. It's the Newfield Plantation. So all this is Southern Kidd Island, from where Greenwood is, going straight down the port hole where you see Andrew DeVoe House and all of that. And then they have the plantations all up there and what would be the foot of Kidd Island. And then Old Bight, where Old Bight is, that was Charles Poitier's plantation at mm-hmm. the time. But he had passed away before all of this happened. Just to put it into context, present at the slave revolt, as a matter of fact, was Frederick Williams Sr., who was only 4 years old at the time, but that is the grandfather of the great Bert Williams, the first black man on Broadway, the first A-list black actor, who was even long before Sidney Poitier.
Wow.
And speaking of Sidney Poitier, March Poitier was also present, who was Sidney Poitier's great-grandfather.
Wow.
You see, was present. Both of them present at the slave revolt that I'm talking about right now.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them have roots in Southern Kidd Island.
And a few people, especially Kidd Islanders, I didn't want to interrupt you, but forgive me. I just want to throw this tidbit in. Know that there is Charles Poitier, a slave owner, had a plantation in Kidd Island. Because we're still trying to conclude where this Poitier surname came from. But of course, Charles Poitier had a plantation there, and whatever it is. But to finish the story, go ahead.
Well, I know exactly what you're referring to. DeVoe is another one that they say. Now, DeVoe and Poitier are French names, whoever they are, French Huguenots or Jacobins or however you want to refer to them as, who were British. They just had French names. Mm-hmm. So they did not come from Haiti, as a lot of people opine.
Mm-hmm.
But you have other names like LaRota.
I know LaRota. That's Dillett's half-brother who came with Stephen Dillett. Exactly. I know LaRota. Right.
Goodman and other names.
And Goodman was another half-brother of Stephen Dillett. There were three brothers with their mother.
Right, as you know. So now back to this revolt. So what happened was it was Dick DeVoe and his two sons as well. So you had Will and Richard. And they was the two rowdy ones as well. And they were armed and everything. And so they, in defiance, gathered up everybody. This was actually a planned uprising because all the women wore petticoats and all the men were stripped and all of them was bareback. And they said they had some white thing on them. So this was like an African thing as well.
Sounds like a ritual.
Oh, yeah. You know, they like say us Kid Island people like do Obi or so.
But that's what yours do. I mean, like we like say, but go ahead.
Right. So this revolt actually ended with, to make a long, long story short, ended with Dick DeVoe firing shots at Joseph Hunter. Charlotte DeVoe and another sister of hers, Linda, they had picked up these rocks and they had guns pointed at them. And I believe that this is what spurred Dick DeVoe to then fire shots at them as well. And then he ended up running away, right? But his sons, there were many things that were said. So Dick DeVoe told Henry Williams to his face that they don't respect and they don't want Joseph Hunter to be their master anymore. And he never did any good for black people. And then he said the same thing to Henry Williams when he tried to tell him to go back to work. You see, so when we get evidence from the enslaved people themselves, not one of them say that slavery was easy in the Bahamas. Find me an enslaved person that said slavery is easy. There is one, actually, but let me be a little trapsy in this. One of them, we have one documentation of a former slave saying slavery was good, and that was from Sam Hunter. Sam Hunter was the one that testified against the 9 people that were put on trial for this uprising in Kid Island.
So what's the conclusion to that?
Sam Hunter was given land and given his freedom for essentially testifying against them. Dick DeVoe was executed. His 2 sons and young guy and one of the women, Charlotte, were also ordered to be executed. But then James Carmichael Smith famously said about Kid Island that he did not execute the other ones because a chain of such feeble links should not be strained. Because during their imprisonment, what a lot of people don't know, was Kid Island was turning upside down during their imprisonment. Because these were people who were known and who were loved, particularly that Charlotte DeVoe, the Obia woman, as I like to call her. Mm-hmm. You see, in the mid-1820s, and this is the research of Bahamian artist, and I call her historian too for this incredible find that she made, there were letters in the mid-1820s that were accusing Charlotte of poisoning the slave masters from Southern Kid Island.
So I'm going to pause right there, right? And people get confused what Obia is. Yes. And Obia, it was mostly rituals, not worship, right? And what they call bush medicine.
Yeah.
Because when they made Obia against the law in the Bahamas, they were making bush medicine against the law, right?
Right.
And what they was afraid of was getting poisoned.
Yeah.
They said, man, they poisoning us and they killing us. They practicing Obia, yeah. Right? And you're saying that Charlotte was doing Obia. She's bixing and killing people. Which is accused of doing such a, I guess.
Well, the evidence is quite strong because anyone who knows about the history of that area, all of those people, all of the enslavers, Sarah Poitier, Joseph Hunter, all of them died within like 2 years of each other, right around the end of slavery. And during the apprenticeship period, because you know when they ended it, so when they said they ended it in 1834, they had to squeeze another 4 years out of us.
Mm-hmm.
Saying that we had to make sure we was ready to be freed. So they had to do another 4 years. But that was just about raising the capital to be able to compensate our slave masters. But I do believe, as well as Tamika Galanis, that Charlotte DeVoe did poison those slave masters in Southern Kid Island, right? And that was essentially would have been the end result of the slave revolt.
Recently, Ian Strawn wrote a novel. I have no. Oh,
and sorry, his sons were sold away from those plantations as well. One ended up in Rum Key, and the other one in Turks and Caicos, I believe, on a salt plant, salt salino, raking salt.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ian Strawn just wrote a book recently, which gave a narration of he created a narrative on poor black Kate.
Right.
Anyone who did history knows what the name Poor Black Kate and by extension Kate Moss.
Yes.
Right? And he gave a story of why Kate's father punished her.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And you made a story about the overseer or the driver trying to be the buffer between the African and the plantation owner.
Certainly.
Right? And in Ian's book, he said that the father may have interfered and punished his daughter in order for her not to get punished vigorously.
That is exact. I actually made the exact same sentiment in my book, in chapter 11, when I focus on women and cruelty towards women in slavery in the Bahamas, you know. So, and that's an astute observation by Mr. Strawn, because when you look at it, that is something that is thing. Now, in the court documents, this is the sinister part about slavery in the Bahamas. They tried to say that, oh, well, this little girl was so rude and this little girl was so defiant that even her father whipped up because he was so upset. And that's not the case, as Mr. Strawn also observed, right? So what happened there is this is just him taking the whip. You know, look like they was probably beating her so bad and stuff. And so you take the whip because you can hit her hard, and he probably was making it look like he was hitting her hard. But, of course, he did it to lessen the blow and try to ensure that she wouldn't lose her life. You know, you never know, you know, even it's just so much. And we don't understand that what our ancestors were going through. We were in this acute survival mode, an extreme fear that was stuck on us for centuries. So this ain't like the type of fear where you got to walk down a dark alley and it's temporary. Then when you pass a dark alley, whoo, no, this is a certain fear. You step out of line, you will be killed. You step out of line, your child will be sold away from you. You step out of line, your wife will be sexually assaulted. These are definites and stuff like that. And people wonder, how is it that three white men can control hundreds of people on a place plantation? That is how. It is like if the, you know, the gang MS-13, the big horrible gang that I don't want to disrespect in no way, shape, or form. Yeah. Of course not.
Disclaimer, go ahead.
Right, but of course. But let's say a little boy, 11, 12-year-old boy, who is the son of one of the leaders of this gang, walking here right now, slap you and slap me.
I can take it.
You can take that. Mm-hmm. Me and you know we could. We'll probably take our belt off and spank shorty. You know, yeah, right? Yeah. Like, we could deal with him. But what comes after that? Mm-hmm. He go tell his dad, that's a whole army coming at you. And that was the same thing. So imagine this solemn attitude after the people in Southern Carolina, as we like to say in the Bahamas, roll out their slave masters and then started to settle. Mother cyclical, we just did. Dick DeVoe know he was dead for sure.
Yes.
For sure.
And we need someone to tell that story. Mm-hmm. Dick, like you said, Dick DeVoe, no, he was dead, right, for sure. And just, when he took up the gun, he realized this is going to end well.
Right. I mean, that's what you know. And these are people who made the ultimate sacrifice. This man lost his life fighting for freedom. But we get Stafford Sands on our dollar bill. You understand what I'm saying?
And we don't have a narrative about Dick DeVoe at all. That not Bahamians can celebrate to say, hey, this is a proud moment in the Bahamian history, especially during our 50th anniversary. People should have been recognized in some way or form.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I was excluded from whatever committee or whatever they form, you know. But that's how I'd go, man. You know, I understand that I'm changing the narrative. I'm going against the grain of what people have been teaching for decades. And they want to continue to keep that narrative.
How important it is for changing the narrative? Because the narrative, this is an African-American term, they say that's his story.
Yeah,
right.
Right, exactly.
And we in the diaspora have adopted it. It's his story, right? As a defiant term. So, my dying really our his story. How important is for you as a historian, a lover of history, someone who's pursuing this knowledge, to retell this story?
Man, this is my life work. This is what I dedicate my life to. You know, this is something that I can't, it's not even a passion, it's an obsession for me. You know, it's something that I dedicate, as I say, my life too. And it's something that Bahamians really need to know. History is the ultimate unifying factor from a nationalist.
How can this unify us when it seems as if you blackening the history?
Well, most of us are black, right? In a few weeks, we celebrate majority rule. Why don't we call it black rule?
Well, a lot of people are trying to change that name too, saying, man, we got to change that to civil rights day, not majority rule.
And they try to water it down even more. But what majority rule, what made us the majority? African heritage. That's what it was. It wasn't your political outlook. It wasn't what churches go to. It wasn't your sexual orientation. It wasn't none of that. It was your African heritage.
I have one of your books to give away, right? And the question is, name me the two ship revolts that Christopher mentioned earlier. If you could call in at 323-6232, 325-4316, 325-4259, and give me the name of the two ships that we had revolts on that Christopher mentioned earlier in the show, you get the copy of the book. You name your book against them.
Black Rinse.
Black Rinse.
A New Perspective of the History of the African Diaspora.
And give me some topics and themes that's in the book.
The Saltwater Underground Railroad, the true origins of John Canoe and who the man and our hero John Canoe actually was, enslaved women in the Bahamas, changing the narratives on these loyalists. That chapter is called The Buckra and the Conky Joe. Slave revolts on the water, slave revolts through arson, slave revolts on the plantation, people that ran away
and
died for our freedom, people like Kwamino, the Bahamas' first and only revolutionary, who's an actual warrior of John Canoe, who tried to take over the entire island of New Providence, beginning with killing Governor Fitzwilliam.
We can talk about that next. We're going to take a quick commercial break. Call I see you if you get the answer. This book, I had to buy my book copy. You could get this book free if you know the answer. This is Guardian Radio AM. We're taking a short break. We're talking to Christopher Davis right now. We're talking history, Bahamian history. But we're taking looking at it through new lenses, a different narrative. And it's important to tell our story instead of his story. We'll be right back.
Can you believe this? We are now the patrol queens of the neighborhood.
We now large and in charge. So we need to check out what's going on in everybody yard. What about that gun that we know that Junior and his homeboys just ran out? Can we report that too?
Of course we can.
But we could be in deep trouble if they find out.
We need to report what we see, Beulah. When you call Crime Stoppers, they just answer your call in Miami.
So then we can report everything? Guns? Where they hiding the drugs? Who shoot who? Who part of which gang? Or who disturbing the peace with the loud music and the motorcycles?
Then our neighborhood will be the best in the Bahamas. And everybody gonna want to come live here. And then our house price will go up, gal.
So what we waiting on? What's the number?
If you see something, say something. Let us all pitch in and stop the crime before it's your time. Call 328-8477 from Nassau or 242-300-8477 from the Family Islands. Or text us through the Crack Crime Bahamas app. Stop the crime before it's your time.
The Grand Bahama News is available every Tuesday in the Nassau Guardian. You can buy your local paper at Freeport convenience stores, Western Bakery, DeGregory's Fine Foods, and Bellevue Gifts. Now is the time to reach your Grand Bahama market with affordable packages, including print and digital. Call GB News sales representative Kavondre at 822-6717 or message him on WhatsApp for ad rates. Classified ads are now available every Tuesday as well. Keep up with everything Grand Bahamian every Tuesday in the Nassau Guardian.
Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM, Nassau, Bahamas.
And welcome back to Guardian Radio in the AM with C.A. Nuri. We have a caller on the line. We go to the caller. I remember this Quarino person. That's from Island of the Stream, yeah. Right? But the name you say it sounds different. So I want to know that story because I know Dick DeVoe tried free 120 Africans.
Yeah.
And you try and say this Quarino trying to free... Hold on. Let me go to the caller first. Caller, are you there?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. You trying to go get this book?
I have a book, so I would not give you the answers. I do know the answers, because I have read...
When you coming on my show, man, you're supposed to make an appointment and you ain't reached yet.
No. You...
Yes,
you
I know it's me.
To get back to me,
yes.
Mr. Nuri.
Yes.
And I'm still waiting for that invitation.
The invitation is there.
No
I
problem.
Need you
I
on
wanna,
the show.
I want to congratulate Mr. Davis for the wonderful work that he's doing.
Thank
I want to commend him for the stand that he's taking to help to educate our people. And I want to lobby along with him to cause the government of the Bahamas and the Ministry of Education in particular to incorporate mandatorily in our school curricula the history, the true history of our people, such as his research and others.
Yes, sir.
I just called simply to thank him, and hopefully we will get the message. And Mr. Nuri, thank you for the opportunity to bring Mr. Davis on so that he can help to educate our people. Until we know our true history, we will never, ever be free in this country.
Thank you very much.
Happy New Year to both of you and your families. All the best in the new year.
Thank you very much. That's Freddie Money Jr. there.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Yes.
And he said it. He said it even better than I could. You know, that's how important our history is. You know, you have so many lies that Americans believe and all. They have their Second Amendment rights and all of these different things. But it unifies them. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
Even, and that's what people have to realize. This history will unify us. There'll be some tough pills to swallow along the way, of course. But what it will do is unify us. Certain things we won't stand for if we learn our history.
I find a lot of Americans are telling behemoth history.
Yeah.
Right? That we are hearing it secondhand. And I said, that happened in the Bahamas? And how come I don't know about that, right? Like, the Creole... No, I can't say that name no more because that's part of the answers. If anyone want to get that book? Again, the number is 323-6232-325-4316, 325-4259. You can call in, and if you give the two ships, we was mentioned on the show, I can't mention it no more. If you give two names, you get a copy of Christopher Davis's book, which goes in detail, and he was giving a list of the top topics, right? And one of those topics was... the African.
Right.
Let me pronounce it. Pronounce the name again for me.
Kwamino. Means born on a Saturday. Friday. So.
And I remember it was referenced in Island of the Stream. But I didn't know the name. The name is kind of different. And I want you to give me a narrative of who this African is.
Okay. So as I always reiterate when I was speaking about the origins of John Canoe, the first three slave ships that came to the Bahamas directly from Africa all came from southern Ghana, present-day Ghana. This is where the people came from. The first one, as a matter of fact, brought the physical warriors of the great Ahanta king, John Canoe, a.k.a. John Kwao, the first, to the Bahamas. That ship was owned by Governor Fenney. The second ship was called the Nassau, and that also came from the same region, as well as taking a few from the present-day eastern Ivory Coast as well. And they brought about 129 enslaved, African captives who were then enslaved in the Bahamas. It was one of those two ships that this man that we are talking about, Kwamino, arrived on. So it's actually very likely that he would have been a physical warrior, a hunter warrior, of the man that we celebrate every Christmas, John Canoe himself. Now, when you understand Caribbean history and history in general, virtually every country, particularly in the English-speaking Caribbean, and English-speaking Americas, we should say, has this proverbial Akan hero, a hero from Ghana. And all of these heroes were either Maroons or revolutionaries. So in Jamaica, of course, you have the most famous one, Queen Nanny.
Mm-hmm.
You also have Captain Cujo, Kwao, and others.
Yes, and they celebrate them. So I want to know how come we're celebrating.
Well, we know why, because we have always had this whitewashed narrative. That is why my book is
But I don't know about him. I reference it. I know the name.
Right.
But to tell me the narrative, how is he important?
So he is important because he is the Bahamas' first and perhaps only true revolutionary. And he devised a plan like his counterparts throughout the Caribbean. So you have Kofi and Guyana. All of these people have these Akan names, right? And so what this does is this includes the Bahamas in the broader pantheon of Akan heroes of the Americas. And in 1734, Kwamino had actually devised a plan. He was living as a petite Maroon, meaning that he was like a Maroon, but not in a grand civilization. He pretty much was living in the bush and surviving away from slavery with a small group of other Africans, right? And he was going around to the plantations that existed in Western New Providence at the time and a few in Eastern New Providence at the time and whispering to this one and whispering to this one so that they would all be aware of his plan. And then he was living as a fugitive for years, actually, it appears. And then he was luckily or unluckily spotted by somebody and they tried to arrest him. When they arrested him, he murdered that first man who actually came, killed him with a dagger. And then they finally subdued the man and then they arrested him. They arrested other people who were around him and even almost the entire enslaved population of the Bahamas at the time, which is probably about between 1,000 and 1,500 people. were all interviewed. And according to Fitzwilliam and the other colonial officials at the time, people like Thomas Walker and others, there was this widespread knowledge of this plot. But of course, him being the leader, he had to take the fall for everybody, and everybody act like they didn't know. But what was clear was he did plan this revolt. As a matter of fact, he wanted to kill all Europeans on the island of
Providence. He wanted to do a Haitian revolution. That man crazy. Let's go to this caller here, producer there. Go ahead, caller. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yeah, how you doing?
Doing well.
The book on yet?
No, the book ain't gone yet. If you don't answer, the book is yours.
The Creole and the Iconian, boy.
No. Okay, give me 1 minute. We're moving the mic back and forth. You get one of the answers right. Okay.
I'm a steady.
No, go repeat your answers again. Choose two answers, and then we'll see if it's right.
The Creole and the Iconian.
Then you were partially right. If you hang up and call back, you're more like you will have it. Yeah, but you basically have the answer. You just need to say it, the two, at the same time. So hang up and call me back.
Okay.
Hopefully you're able to call before someone else called, right? I have a text who said that there was a Davis, touch on the ship that brought the Davis man who didn't want to give up his slaves and left the United States to go to Cat Island. I'm not sure who that is. You know anything about that?
I think they might be referring to Jacob Davis.
Who's Jacob Davis?
Jacob Davis was the dominant owner of enslaved Davises. That is actually where the prime minister's ancestry lies as well, right there in Old Bycatt Island. And his brother George Davis was the one who had also a large plantation full of Davises around Warwick Wells, a.k.a. Barry Tarry in North Exuma.
Okay, let me get to this caller. I want to hear more about that. Go ahead, caller. Can you hear me? Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I'm a sad and the Iconian.
Okay, yes. No. I can give you the book. The right answer is the Amistad and the Creole.
The Amistad and the Creole, right. He said the Iconium twice, but he got
that. Yeah, he even said it wrong, but the book is yours. Yeah. What you do is leave your name and a number with the producer, and the book will be left downstairs at the guiding concierge for you.
Oh, hey, what's the guy? What is Christopher's website?
You have a website, Christopher?
Sankofa Flamingo on Facebook and Twitter.
Spell that, boy.
And I can spell it. And TikTok. SANKOFA.
Okay.
Flamingo.
Okay. My name is San Creole.
No, it ain't Creole. It's African from Ghana, actually. Sankofa is what you call in a Dinkra symbol, the Sankofa bird. And it means go back and get it and use it in the future.
I tell you, history.
Yeah. And flamingo is our national bird.
Go on, buddy.
We know. Yeah.
So the book is yours. You just collect it at the Guardian concierge desk. Your name. Make sure to leave your name and number with the with the producer. Okay? And producer, pass the next caller for me. Again.
Thank you.
Go ahead, caller. Can you hear me?
Yeah, good morning, Mr. Nuri. Good morning, Mr.
John Kwa.
Canoe.
Yeah, John Canoe the second.
Chris, listen, man. you know, I see you, Nuri. I sit and listen to the show, right? Mm-hmm. I enjoy Chris with the intricate history of the Bahamas itself. And so because I didn't hear him say Amistad, I came in and he was talking about the Creole, the ship.
Right.
But I knew the Amistad is the ship that Shaka Zulu was on. But I didn't want to call and say the Amistad because I haven't read the book.
Segbe Pia.
It's going to be in a free book right there, man. You know what I mean? But I just wanted to ask Chris, you know, my grandfather was from Cat Island, right?
Yes, sir.
And he's a McDonald. And so, you know, as a young man, when I used to go to primary school, he used to always tell us stories in fishing and all that. Fishing stories, etc. And he always said Sidney Poitier was his cousin or his family.
Right.
And so is there any way to prove that? Not that I really care, but it's just that they're from Cat Island. And so he was born in 1907. So maybe it's true. So
what I'm saying, probably true. It probably is. Yeah.
Yeah. This is how we lose our history.
Right.
You understand what I'm saying? But I didn't want to be presumptuous and call and say the Amistad. But I actually knew the Amistad was one of the ships where we both took place with the Shaka Zulu tribe. Give thanks, the Zulu. Give thanks.
All right.
Okay. Yeah. Producer, I think this is a gentleman calling back with his name and number. Should collect that. And before we conclude, I want us to give the topics of your book again. and brief summary on what that is. We only have 6 minutes, so you do everything quickly.
Okay, so I actually do the Kitabah contents off the top of my head, essentially. So it's chapter one, deals with identifying our Africanness and who we are, and also begins to segue into some of the problematic narratives dealing with Bahamian history and how that also parallels globally. So it's not like this is something that just is in the Bahamas, you know. In the United States, all over, Dominican Republic, everywhere you look, there's this struggle for African history and Black history, or at least our perspective to be heard and even told in the first place. That's whether in the halls of academia or on the road. So then chapter two deals encountering that victim-blaming narrative. And this is where we begin to touch into our own people, some of the people that was here in the Bahamas as well. Africans who wrote about their lives, wrote about their
experiences. We had Africans who read about their lives in the Bahamas?
Oh, yeah. We have some. We have one in particular named Abul Kelly. He didn't write about his life, but he wrote three very strong letters towards Governor James Carmichael Smith.
An African wrote that in the Bahamas?
Oh, yeah.
And we have the records of that?
Oh, yes.
And you put that in the book?
It's right there in my book, all about Abul Kelly as well. Now, third chapter is probably the most controversial one. I think you said that was your favorite chapter, mm-hmm. The Bukra and the Conky Joe.
And a few people know what Bukra is, but for them, I call it a Gullah Geechee word, meaning white man.
Right, exactly. It's, yes. It's an old Gullah Geechee word that means white man. Not even in a negative or positive context, it just means white man.
Yeah, they came across and said, the Bukra is here. Yeah.
Right.
And mind you, I argue with Nicolette Bethel that this Gullah Geechee language, mm-hmm. and this Bahamian dialect is a plantation language because we shared a Bukra language, and Bukra spoke this dialect also.
Right.
But that's me. My research differently.
It's a mixture of the two, you know, because in that colonial space, you will definitely have that, of course, thing, you know. The reason we don't use Bukra anymore is because the white people say
it's a negative word.
And they could beat us if we use it.
Yes. So we don't use the word Bukra no more.
Exactly. You see?
Finish the book.
Now, chapter 4 and 5 is when we segue into our great hero, John Canoe. So chapter 4 deals with these myths and this African celebration and how these myths occur and some of the other African groups that have influenced it. And then chapter 5 gets into who John Canoe really was and why we celebrate him, who the Hunter people are, and why we should also celebrate them as not only heroes to the Bahamas, but like John Canoe, heroes for the entire diaspora, representative of African autonomy and freedom. Okay, then chapter 6, we're getting a little closer to home. We talk about kind of day-to-day resistance and small revolts. That's where we talk about arson. So, for example, on the Sayers Plantation in Little Exuma, and in Rumkey, Dwight Strawn people, shout out to Dwight Strawn on Mount Misery, where they attempted to kill their slave masters' families by setting fire to their homes while they were sleeping inside.
These Africans was violent, man.
Oh, man. And then there were at least two occasions where they even attempted to burn down the city of Nassau, one in 1828 or thereabouts. And even Stephen Dillard got mixed up in one.
And they say French Africans do that?
That's what they say.
That's them said from down south.
Yeah, but it wasn't like that. Some of them, they had last names like Edgecombe and Tucker and Thompson and stuff like that. They ain't no quote-unquote Haitian last names. Mm. I know it, right?
Okay.
Now, chapter, what am I on? 7 now starts to deal with Maroonage in the Bahamas. And this is where we talk about the Saltwater Underground Railroad, as well as chapter 8. Chapter 9 deals specifically with the relationship between Haiti and the Bahamas, focusing on the Haitian Revolution's effects, attempted revolts that was done by consortiums of Haitians and Bahamians, as well as arguably the greatest single runaway in a single day, where hundreds of Bahamians ran away and got free in Haiti.
Anyway, it's 12 o'clock. I got to bring you back. I know a different story I got to say. Anyway, Guardian Radio in the AM with T.A. Newey. Have a beautiful day.